This conversation's grammar was defined in 1982 by John Postel, one of the Internet's heroic forefathers, who used to literally run the most important servers on the net under his desk at the University of Southern California back in the Paleolithic era. Now, imagine that you hooked up a mail server to an IM session. You could send an IM to the server that said, "Hello, littlebrother.com.se," and it would reply with 250mail.pirateparty.org.se. "Hello, mail.pirateparty.org.se. Pleased to meet you." In other words, you could have the same conversation over IM as you do over SMTP. With the right tweaks, the whole mail server business could take place inside of a chat, or a web session, or anything else. This is called tunneling. You put the SMTP inside a chat tunnel. You could then put the chat back into an SMTP tunnel, if you wanted to be really weird, tunneling the tunnel in another tunnel. In fact, every internet protocol is susceptible to this process. It's cool because it means that if you're on a network with only web access, you can tunnel your mail over it. You can tunnel your favorite P2P over it. You can even tunnel XNET, which itself is a tunnel for dozens of protocols, over it. Domain name service is an interesting and ancient internet protocol, dating back to 1983. It's the way your computer converts a computer's name, like pirateparty.org.se, to the IP number that computers actually use to talk to each other over the net, like 204.11.50.136. It generally works like magic, even though it's got millions of moving parts. Every ISP runs a DNS server, as do most governments and lots of private operators. These DNS boxes all talk to each other all the time, making and filling requests to each other, so no matter how obscure the name is you feed to your computer, it will be able to turn it into a number. Before DNS, there was the hosts file. Believe it or not, this was a single document that listed the name and address of every single computer connected to the Internet. Every computer had a copy of it. This file was eventually too big to move around, so DNS was invented and ran on a server that used to live under John Postel's desk. If the cleaners knocked out the plug, the entire Internet lost its ability to find itself. Seriously. The thing about DNS today is that it's everywhere. Every network has a DNS server living on it, and all those servers are configured to talk to each other and to random people all over the Internet. What Masha had done was figure out a way to tunnel a video streaming system over DNS. She was breaking up the video into billions of pieces and hiding each of them in a normal message to a DNS server. By running her code, I was able to pull the video from all those DNS servers all over the Internet at incredible speed. It must have looked bizarre on the network histograms, like I was looking up the address of every computer in the world. But it had two advantages I appreciated at once. I was able to get the video with blinding speed. As soon as I clicked the first link, I started to receive full-screen pictures without any jitter or stuttering. And I had no idea where it was hosted. It was totally anonymous. At first, I didn't even clock the content of the video. I was totally floored by the cleverness of this hack. Streaming video from DNS? That was so smart and weird. It was practically perverted. Gradually, what I was seeing began to sink in. It was a boardroom table in a small room with a mirror down one wall. I knew that room. I'd sat in that room while severe haircut lady had made me speak my password aloud. There were five comfortable chairs around the table, each with a comfortable person, all in DHS uniform. I recognized Major General Graham Sutherland, the DHS Bay Area commander, along with Severe Haircut. The others were new to me. They all watched a video screen at the end of the table, on which there was an infinitely more familiar face. Kurt Rooney was known nationally as the president's chief strategist, the man who returned the party for its third term and who was steaming toward a fourth. They called him Ruthless, and I'd seen a news report once about how tight a rein he kept his staffers on, calling them, IMing them, watching their every motion, controlling every step. He was old, with a lined face and pale gray eyes, and a flat nose, with broad, flared nostrils and thin lips. A man who looked like he was smelling something bad all the time. He was the man on the screen. He was talking, and everyone else was focused on his screen, everyone taking notes as fast as they could type, trying to look smart. "Say that they're angry with authority, but we need to show the country that it's terrorists, not the government, that they need to blame. Do you understand me? The nation does not love that city. As far as they're concerned, it's a Sodom and Gomorrah of fags and atheists who deserve to rot in hell. The only reason the country cares what they think in San Francisco is that they had the good fortune to have been blown to hell by some Islamic terrorists. These ex-net children are getting to the point where they might start to be useful to us. The more radical they get, the more the rest of the nation understands that there are threats everywhere." His audience finished typing. "We can control that, I think," Severe Haircut said. "Our people in the X-Net have built up a lot of influence. The Manchurian bloggers are running as many as 50 blogs each, flooding the chat channels, linking to each other, mostly just taking the party line set by this Mikey. But they've already shown that they can provoke radical action even when Mikey is putting the brakes on."
Major General Sutherland nodded. "We have been planning to leave them underground until about a month before the midterms." I guessed that meant the midterm elections, not my exams. "That's per the original plan. But it sounds like..."
"We've got another plan for the midterms," Rooney said. "Need to know, of course. But you should all probably not plan on traveling for the month before. Cut the X-Net loose now, as soon as you can. So long as they're moderates, they're a liability. Keep them radical."
The video cut off. Ange and I sat on the edge of the bed, looking at the screen. Ange reached out and started the video again. We watched it. It was worse the second time. I tossed the keyboard aside and got up.
"I am so sick of being scared," I said. "Let's take this to Barbara and have her publish it all. Put it all on the net. Let them take me away. At least I'll know what's going to happen then. At least then I'll have a little certainty in my life."
Ange grabbed me and hugged me, soothed me.
"I know, baby, I know. It's all terrible. But you're focusing on the bad stuff and ignoring the good stuff. You've created a movement. You've outflanked the jerks in the White House, the crooks in DHS uniforms. You've put yourself in a position where you could be responsible for blowing the lid off the entire rotten DHS thing. Sure, they're out to get you. Of course they are. Have you ever doubted it for a moment? I always figured they were. But Marcus, they don't know who you are. Think about that. All those people, money, guns, and spies, and you, a 17-year-old high school kid, you're still beating them. They don't know about Barbara. They don't know about Zeb. You've jammed them in the streets of San Francisco and humiliated them before the world. So stop moping, all right? You're winning."
"They're coming for me, though. You see that? They're going to put me in jail forever. Not even jail. I'll just disappear, like Daryl. Maybe worse. Maybe Syria. Why leave me in San Francisco? I'm a liability as long as I'm in the USA. She sat down on the bed with me.
"Yeah,"
she said.
"That.
That.
Well, you know what you have to do, right?"
"What?" She looked pointedly at my keyboard. I could see the tears rolling down her cheeks.
"No. You're out of your mind. You think I'm going to run off with some nut off the internet? Some spy? You got a better idea?"
I kicked a pile of her laundry into the air. Whatever, fine, I'll talk to her some more.
You talk to her, Ange said. You tell her you and your girlfriend are getting out.
What?
Shut up, dickhead. You think you're in danger? I'm in just as much danger, Marcus. It's called guilt by association. When you go, I go.
She had her jaw thrust out at a mutinous angle.
You and I. We're together now. You have to understand that.
We sat down on the bed together.
Unless you don't want me,
she said finally, in a small voice. You're kidding me, right?
Do I look like I'm kidding?
There's no way I would voluntarily go without you, Ange. I could never have asked you to come, but I'm ecstatic that you offered. She smiled and tossed me my keyboard.
Email this Masha creature. Let's see what this chick can do for us.
I emailed her, encrypting the message, waiting for a reply. Ange nuzzled me a little, and I kissed her, and we necked. Something about the danger and the pact to go together. It made me forget the awkwardness of having sex. Made me freaking horny as hell. We were half naked again when Masha's email arrived.
Two of you? Jesus, like it won't be hard enough already. I don't get to leave except to do field intelligence after a big X-Net hit. You get me? The handlers watch my every move, but I go off the leash when something big happens with X-Netters. I get sent into the field then. You do something big. I get sent to it. I get us both out. All three of us, if you insist. Make it fast, though. I can't send you a lot of email, understand? They watch me. They're closing in on you. You don't have a lot of time. Weeks? Maybe just days. I need you to get me out. That's why I'm doing this, in case you're wondering. I can't escape on my own. I need a big X-Net distraction. That's your department. Don't fail me, Mikey, or we're both dead. You're girly, too. Masha.
My phone rang, making us both jump. It was my mom wanting to know when I was coming home. I told her I was on my way. She didn't mention Barbara. We'd agreed that we wouldn't talk about any of this stuff on the phone. That was my dad's idea. He could be as paranoid as me. I have to go, I said.
Our parents will be...
I know, I said. I saw what happened to my parents when they thought I was dead. Knowing that I'm a fugitive isn't going to be much better, but they'd rather I be a fugitive than a prisoner. That's what I think. Anyway, once we disappear, Barbara can publish without worrying about getting us into trouble. We kissed at the door of a room. Not one of the hot, sloppy numbers we usually did when parting ways. A sweet kiss this time. A slow kiss. A goodbye kind of kiss. BART rides are introspective. When the train rocks back and forth and you try not to make eye contact with the other riders and you try not to read the ads for plastic surgery, bail bondsmen, and AIDS testing, when you try to ignore the graffiti and not look too closely at the stuff in the carpeting, that's when your mind starts to really churn and churn. You rock back and forth and your mind goes over all the things you've overlooked, plays back all the movies of your life where you're no hero, where you're a chump or a sucker. Your brain comes up with theories like this one. If the DHS wanted to catch Mikey, what better way than to lure him into the open, panic him into leading some kind of big public X-Net event? Wouldn't that be worth the chance of a compromising video leaking? Your brain comes up with stuff like that, even when the train ride only lasts two or three stops. When you get off and you start moving, the blood gets running and sometimes your brain helps you out again. Sometimes your brain gives you solutions. In addition to problems. Chapter 18. There was a time when my favorite thing in the world was putting on a cape and hanging out in hotels, pretending to be an invisible vampire whom everyone stared at. It's complicated and not nearly as weird as it sounds. The live-action role-playing scene combines the best aspects of D&D with drama club with going to sci-fi cons. I understand that this might not make it sound as appealing to you as it was to me when I was 14. The best games were the ones at the scout camps out of town. 100 teenagers, boys and girls, fighting the Friday night traffic, swapping stories, playing handheld games, showing off for hours. Then, debarking to stand in the grass before a group of older men and women in badass homemade armor, dented and scarred, like armor must have been in the old days, not like it's portrayed in the movies, but like a soldier's uniform after a month in the bush. These people were nominally paid to run the games, but you didn't get the job unless you were the kind of person who'd do it for free. They'd have already divided us into teams based on the questionnaires we'd filled in beforehand, and we'd get our team assignments then, like being called up for baseball sides. Then you'd get your briefing packages. These were like the briefings the spies get in the movies. Here's your identity. Here's your mission. Here's the secrets you know about the group. From there, it was time for dinner. Roaring fires, meat popping on spits, tofu sizzling on skillets. It's Northern California. A vegetarian option is not optional. And a style of eating and drinking that can only be described as quaffing. Already, the keen kids would be getting into character. My first game, I was a wizard. I had a bag of bean bags that represented spells. When I threw one, I would shout the name of the spell I was casting. Fireball, magic missile, cone of light, and the player or monster I threw it at would keel over if I connected. Or not. Sometimes we had to call in a ref to mediate, but for the most part, we were all pretty good about playing fair. No one liked a dice lawyer. By bedtime, we were all in character. At 14, I wasn't super sure what a wizard was supposed to sound like, but I could take my cues from the movies and novels. I spoke in slow, measured tones, keeping my face composed in a suitably mystical expression, and thinking mystical thoughts. The mission was complicated, retrieving a sacred relic that had been stolen by an ogre who was bent on subjugating the people of the land to his will. It didn't really matter a whole lot. What mattered was that I had a private mission to capture a certain kind of imp to serve as my familiar, and that I had a secret nemesis, another player on the team who had taken part in a raid that killed my family when I was a boy, a player who didn't know that I'd come back, bent on revenge. Somewhere, of course, there was another player with a similar grudge against me, so that even as I was enjoying the camaraderie of the team, I'd always have to keep an eye open for a knife in the back, poison in the food. For the next 2 days, we played it out. There were parts of the weekend that were like hide-and-seek, some that were like wilderness survival exercises, some that were like solving crossword puzzles. The game masters had done a great job, and you really got to be friends with the other people on the mission. Daryl was the target of my first murder, and I put my back into it, even though he was my pal. Nice guy. Shame I'd have to kill him. I fireballed him as he was seeking out treasure, after we wiped out a band of orcs, playing rock, paper, scissors with each orc to determine who would prevail in combat. This is a lot more exciting than it sounds. It was like summer camp for drama geeks. We talked until late at night in tents, looked at the stars, jumped in the river when we got hot, slapped away mosquitoes, became best friends or lifelong enemies. I don't know why Charles's parents sent him LARPing. He wasn't the kind of kid who really enjoyed that kind of thing. He was more the pulling wings off flies type. Oh, maybe not. But he just was not into being in costume in the woods. He spent the whole time mooching around, sneering at everyone and everything, trying to convince us all that we weren't having the good time we all felt like we were having. You've no doubt found that kind of person before, the kind of person who is compelled to ensure that everyone else has a rotten time. The other thing about Charles was that he couldn't get the hang of simulated combat. Once you start running around the woods and playing these elaborate semi-military games, it's easy to get totally adrenalized to the point where you're ready to tear out someone's throat. This is not a good state to be in when you're carrying a prop sword, club, pike, or other utensil. This is why no one is ever allowed to hit anyone under any circumstances in these games. Instead, when you get close enough to someone to fight, you play a quick couple rounds of rock, paper, scissors, with modifiers based on your experience, armaments, and condition. The referees mediate disputes. It's quite civilized, and a little weird. You go running after someone through the woods, catch up with him, bare your teeth, and sit down to play a little Rochambeau. But it works, and it keeps everything safe and fun. Charles couldn't really get the hang of this. I think he was perfectly capable of understanding that the rule was no contact, but he was simultaneously capable of deciding that the rule didn't matter and that he wasn't going to abide by it. The refs called him on it a bunch of times over the weekend, and he kept on promising to stick by it and kept on going back. He was one of the bigger kids there already, and he was fond of accidentally tackling you at the end of a chase. Not fun when you get tackled into the rocky forest floor. I had just mightily smote Daryl in a little clearing where he'd been treasure hunting, and we were having a little laugh over my extreme sneakiness. He was going to go monstering. Killed players could switch to playing monsters, which meant that the longer the game wore on, the more monsters there were coming after you, meaning that everyone got to keep on playing, and the game's battles just got more and more epic. That was when Charles came out of the woods behind me and tackled me, throwing me to the ground so hard that I couldn't breathe for a moment. "Gotcha!" he yelled. I only knew him slightly before this, and I'd never thought much of him, but now I was ready for murder. I climbed slowly to my feet and looked at him, his chest heaving, grinning. "You're so dead," he said. "I totally got you." I smiled, and something felt wrong and sore in my face. I touched my upper lip. It was bloody. My nose was bleeding, and my lip was split, cut on a root I'd face-planted into when he tackled me. I wiped the blood on my pants leg and smiled. I made like I thought that it was all in fun. I laughed a little. I moved toward him. Charles wasn't fooled. He was already backing away, trying to fade into the woods. Daryl moved to flank him. I took the other flank. Abruptly, he turned and ran. Daryl's foot hooked his ankle and sent him sprawling. We rushed him, just in time to hear a ref's whistle. The ref hadn't seen Charles foul me, but he'd seen Charles's play that weekend. He sent Charles back to the camp entrance and told him he was out of the game. Charles complained mightily, but to our satisfaction, the ref wasn't having any of it. Once Charles had gone, he gave us both a lecture too, telling us that our retaliation was no more justified than Charles's attack. It was okay. That night, once the games had ended, we all got hot showers in the scout dorms. Daryl and I stole Charles's clothes and towel. We tied them in knots and dropped them in the urinal. A lot of the boys were happy to contribute to the effort of soaking them. Charles had been very enthusiastic about his tackles. I wish I could have watched him when he got out of his shower and discovered his clothes. It's a hard decision. Do you run naked across the camp, or pick apart the tight, piss-soaked knots in your clothes and then put them on? He chose nudity. I probably would have chosen the same. We lined up along the route from the showers to the shed where the packs were stored and applauded him. I was at the front of the line, leading the applause. The scout camp weekends only came 3 or 4 times a year, which left Daryl and me, and lots of other LARPers, with a serious LARP deficiency in our lives. Luckily, there were the Wretched Daylight games in the city hotels. Wretched Daylight is another LARP. Rival vampire clans and vampire hunters, and it's got its own quirky rules. Players get cards to help them resolve combat skirmishes, so each skirmish involves playing a little hand of a strategic card game. Vampires can become invisible by cloaking themselves, crossing their arms over their chests, and all the other players have to pretend they don't see them, continuing with their conversations about their plans and so on. The true test of a good player is whether you're honest enough to go on spilling your secrets in front of an invisible rival without acting as though he was in the room. There were a couple of big Wretched Daylight games every month. The organizers of the games had a good relationship with the city's hotels, and they let it be known that they'd take 10 unbooked rooms on Friday night and fill them with players who'd run around the hotel, playing low-key Wretched Daylight in the corridors, around the pool, and so on, eating at the hotel restaurant, and paying for the hotel Wi-Fi. They'd close the booking on Friday afternoon, email us, and we'd go straight from school to whichever hotel it was, bringing our knapsacks, sleeping 6 or 8 to a room for the weekend, living on junk food, playing until 3 a.m. It was good, safe fun that our parents could get behind. The organizers were a well-known literacy charity that ran kids' writing workshops, drama workshops, and so on. They had been running the games for 10 years without incident. Everything was strictly booze and drug-free to keep the organizers from getting busted on some kind of corruption of minors rap. We'd draw between 10 and 100 players, depending on the weekend, and for the cost of a couple movies, you could have 2.5 days' worth of solid fun. One day, though, they lucked into a block of rooms at the Monaco, a hotel in the Tenderloin that catered to arty older tourists, the kind of place where every room came with a goldfish bowl, where the lobby was full of beautiful old people in fine clothes, showing off their plastic surgery results. Normally, the mundanes, our word for non-players, just ignored us, figuring that we were skylarking kids. But that weekend, there happened to be an editor for an Italian travel magazine staying, and he took an interest in things. He cornered me as I skulked in the lobby, hoping to spot the clanmaster of my rivals and swoop in on him and draw his blood. I was standing against the wall with my arms folded over my chest, being invisible, when he came up to me and asked me, in accented English, what me and my friends were doing in the hotel that weekend. I tried to brush him off, but he wouldn't be put off. So I figured I'd just make something up, and he'd go away. I didn't imagine that he'd print it. I really didn't imagine that it would get picked up by the American press. "We're here because our prince has died, and so we've had to come in search of a new ruler." "A prince?" "Yes," I said, getting into it. "We're the old people. We came to America in the 16th century and have had our own royal family in the wilds of Pennsylvania ever since. We live simply in the woods. We don't use modern technology, but the prince was the last of the line, and he died last week. Some terrible wasting disease took him. The young men of my clan have left to find the descendants of his great uncle, who went away to join the modern people in the time of my grandfather. He is said to have multiplied, and we will find the last of his bloodline and bring them back to their rightful home." I've read a lot of fantasy novels. This kind of thing came easily to me. "We found a woman who knew of these descendants. She told us one was staying in this hotel, and we've come to find him. But we've been tracked here by a rival clan who would keep us from bringing home our prince, to keep us weak and easy to dominate. Thus, it is vital we keep to ourselves. We do not talk to the new people when we can help it. Talking to you now causes me great discomfort." He was watching me shrewdly. I had uncrossed my arms, which meant that I was now visible to rival vampires, one of whom had been slowly sneaking up on us. At the last moment, I turned and saw her, arms spread, hissing at us, vamping it up in high style. I threw my arms wide and hissed back at her, then pelted through the lobby, hopping over a leather sofa and deking around a potted plant, making her chase me. I'd scouted an escape route down through the stairwell to the basement health club, and I took it, shaking her off. I didn't see him again that weekend, but I did relate the story to some of my fellow LARPers, who embroidered the tale and found lots of opportunities to tell it over the weekend. The Italian magazine had a staffer who'd done her master's degree on Amish anti-technology communities in rural Pennsylvania, and she thought we sounded awfully interesting. Based on the notes and taped interviews of her boss from his trip to San Francisco, she wrote a fascinating, heart-wrenching article about these weird juvenile cultists who were crisscrossing America in search of their prince. Hell, people will print anything these days. But the thing was, stories like that get picked up and republished. First it was Italian bloggers, then a few American bloggers. People across the country reported sightings of the old people, though whether they were making it up or whether others were playing the same game, I didn't know. It worked its way up the media food chain all the way to the New York Times, who, unfortunately, have an unhealthy appetite for fact-checking. The reporter they put on the story eventually tracked it down to the Monaco Hotel, who put them in touch with the LARP organizers, who laughingly spilled the whole story. Well, at that point, LARPing got a lot less cool. We became known as the nation's foremost hoaxers, as weird, pathological liars. The press who we'd inadvertently tricked into covering the story of the old people were now interested in redeeming themselves by reporting on how unbelievably weird we LARPers were. And that was when Charles let everyone in school know that Daryl and I were the biggest LARPing weenies in the city. That was not a good season. Some of the gang didn't mind, but we did. The teasing was merciless. Charles let it. I'd find plastic fangs in my bag, and kids I passed in the hall would go, "Bleh, bleh," like a cartoon vampire, or they'd talk with fake Transylvanian accents when I was around. We switched to arguing pretty soon afterward. It was more fun in some ways, and it was a lot less weird. Every now and again, though, I missed my cape and those weekends in the hotel. The opposite of esprit d'escalier is the way that life's embarrassments come back to haunt us, even after they're long past. I could remember every stupid thing I'd ever said or done, recall them with picture-perfect clarity. Any time I was feeling low, I'd naturally start to remember other times I felt that way, a hit parade of humiliations coming one after another to my mind. As I tried to concentrate on Masha and my impending doom, the old people incident kept coming back to haunt me. There'd been a similar sick, sinking, doomed feeling then, as more and more press outlets picked up the story, as the likelihood of someone figuring out that it had been me who'd sprung the story on the stupid Italian editor in the designer jeans with crooked seams, the starched collarless shirt, and the oversized metal-rimmed glasses. There's an alternative to dwelling on your mistakes. You can learn from them. It's a good theory, anyway. Maybe the reason your subconscious dredges up all these miserable ghosts is that they need to get closure before they can rest peacefully in humiliation afterlife. My subconscious kept visiting me with ghosts in the hopes that I would do something to let them rest in peace. All the way home, I turned over this memory and the thought of what I would do about Masha in case she was playing me. I needed some insurance. And by the time I reached my house, to be swept up into melancholy hugs from Mom and Dad, I had it. The trick was to time this so that it happened fast enough that the DHS couldn't prepare for it, but with a long enough lead time that the X-Net would have time to turn out in force. The trick was to stage this so that there were too many present to arrest us all, but to put it somewhere that the press could see it and the grown-ups, so the DHS wouldn't just gas us again. The trick was to come up with something with the media friendliness of the levitation of the Pentagon. The trick was to stage something that we could rally around, like 3,000 Berkeley students refusing to let one of their number be taken away in a police van. The trick was to put the press there, ready to say what the police did, the way they had in 1968 in Chicago. It was going to be some trick. I cut out of school an hour early the next day, using my customary techniques for getting out, not caring if it would trigger some kind of new DHS checker that would result in my parents getting a note. One way or another, my parents' last problem after tomorrow would be whether I was in trouble at school. I met Ange at her place. She'd had to cut out of school even earlier, but she'd just made a big deal out of her cramps and pretended she was going to keel over, and they sent her home. We started to spread the word on XNet. We sent it in email to trusted friends and IM'd it to our buddy lists. We roamed the decks and towns of Clockwork Plunder and told our teammates. Giving everyone enough information to get them to show up, but not so much as to tip our hand to the DHS, was tricky, but I thought I had just the right balance. Vamp mob tomorrow. If you're a goth, dress to impress. If you're not a goth, find a goth and borrow some clothes. Think vampire. The game starts at 8 a.m. sharp. Sharp. Be there and ready to be divided into teams. The game lasts 30 minutes, so you'll have plenty of time to get to school afterward. Location will be revealed tomorrow. Email your public key to mikey@littlebrother.pirateparty.org.se and check your messages at 7 a.m. for the update. If that's too early for you, stay up all night. That's what we're going to do. This is the most fun you will have all year. Guaranteed. Believe. Mikey. Then I sent a short message to Masha. Tomorrow. Mikey. A minute later, she emailed back. I thought so. Vamp mob, huh? You work fast. Wear a red hat. Travel light. What do you bring along when you go fugitive? I'd carried enough heavy packs around enough scout camps to know that every ounce you add cuts into your shoulders with all the crushing force of gravity with every step you take. It's not just 1 ounce. It's 1 ounce that you carry for a million steps. It's a ton. Right, Ange said. Smart. And you never take more than 3 days' worth of clothes, either. You can rinse stuff out in the sink. Better to have a spot on your T-shirt than a suitcase that's too big and heavy to stash under a plane seat. She'd pulled out a ballistic nylon courier bag that went across her chest, between her breasts, something that made me get a little sweaty, and slung diagonally across her back. It was roomy inside, and she'd set it down on the bed. Now she was piling clothes next to it. I figure that 3 T-shirts, a pair of pants, a pair of shorts, 3 changes of underwear, 3 pairs of socks and a sweater will do it. She dumped out her gym bag and picked out her toiletries. I'll have to remember to stick my toothbrush in tomorrow morning before I head down to Civic Center. Watching her pack was impressive. She was ruthless about it all. It was also freaky. It made me realize that the next day, I was going to go away. Maybe for a long time. Maybe forever. Do I bring my Xbox? She asked. I've got a ton of stuff on the hard drive, notes and sketches and email. I wouldn't want it to fall into the wrong hands. It's all encrypted, I said. That's standard with paranoid Xbox. But leave the Xbox behind. There will be plenty of them in L.A. Just create a Pirate Party account and email an image of your hard drive to yourself. I'm going to do the same when I get home. She did so and queued up the email. It was going to take a couple of hours for all the data to squeeze through her neighbor's Wi-Fi network and wing its way to Sweden. Then she closed the flap on the bag and tightened the compression straps. She had something the size of a soccer ball slung over her back now, and I stared admiringly at it. She could walk down the street with that under her shoulder, and no one would look twice. She looked like she was on her way to school. "One more thing," she said, and went to her bedside table and took out the condoms. She took the strips of rubbers out of the box and opened the bag and stuck them inside, then gave me a slap on the ass. "Now what?" I said.
"Now we go to your place and do your stuff. It's time I met your parents, no?"
She left the bag amid the piles of clothes and junk all over the floor. She was ready to turn her back on all of it, walk away, just to be with me, just to support the cause. It made me feel brave, too. Mom was already home when I got there. She had her laptop open on the kitchen table and was answering email while talking into a headset connected to it, helping some poor Yorkshire man and his family acclimate to living in Louisiana. I came through the door, and Ange followed, grinning like mad, but holding my hand so tight I could feel the bones grinding together. I didn't know what she was so worried about. It wasn't like she was going to end up spending a lot of time hanging around with my parents after this, even if it went badly. Mom hung up on the Yorkshireman when we got in.
"Hello, Marcus," she said, giving me a kiss on the cheek. "And who is this?"
"Mom, meet Ange. Ange, this is my mom, Louisa." Mom stood up and gave Ange a hug.
"It's very good to meet you, darling," she said, looking her over from top to bottom. Ange looked pretty acceptable, I think. She dressed well and low-key, and you could tell how smart she was just by looking at her.
"A pleasure to meet you, Mrs. Yallow," she said. She sounded very confident and self-assured, much better than I had when I'd met her mom.
"It's Louisa, love," she said. She was taking in every detail.
"Are you staying for dinner?"
"I'd love that," she said.
"Do you eat meat?"
Mom's pretty acclimated to living in California.
"I eat anything that doesn't eat me first," she said.
"She's a hot sauce junkie," I said. "You could serve her old tires, and she'd eat 'em if she could smother them in salsa." Ange socked me gently in the shoulder.
"I was going to order Thai," Mom said. "I'll add a couple of their 5 chili dishes to the order."
Ange thanked her politely, and Mom bustled around the kitchen, getting us glasses of juice and a plate of biscuits, and asking 3 times if we wanted any tea. I squirmed a little. "Thanks, Mom," I said. "We're going to go upstairs for a while." Mom's eyes narrowed for a second. Then she smiled again.
"Of course," she said. "Your father will be home in an hour. We'll eat then."
I had my vampire stuff all stashed in the back of my closet. I let Ange sort through it while I went through my clothes. I was only going as far as L.A. They had stores there, all the clothing I could need. I just needed to get together 3 or 4 favorite tees and a favorite pair of jeans, a tube of deodorant, a roll of dental floss.
"Money," I said.
"Yeah,"
she said.
"I was going to clean out my bank account on the way home at an ATM. I've got maybe $1,500 saved up."
"Really?
What am I going to spend it on?" she said. "Ever since the X-Net, I haven't had to even pay any service charges.
I think I've got $300 or so."
"Well, there you go. Grab it on the way to Civic Center in the morning."
I had a big book bag I used when I was hauling lots of gear around town. It was less conspicuous than my camping pack. Ange went through my piles mercilessly and culled them down to her favorites. Once it was packed and under my bed, we both sat down.
We're going to have to get up really early tomorrow, she said.
Yeah, big day.
The plan was to get messages out with a bunch of fake vamp mob locations tomorrow, sending people out to secluded spots within a few minutes' walk of Civic Center. We'd cut out a spray paint stencil that just said Vamp Mob Civic Center, Arrow, that we would spray paint at those spots around 5 a.m. That would keep the DHS from locking down Civic Center before we got there. I had the mailbot ready to send out the messages at 7 a.m. I'd just leave my Xbox running when I went out.
How long?
She trailed off.
That's what I've been wondering, too, I said. It could be a long time, I suppose.
But who knows? With Barbara's article coming out, I'd queued an email to her for the next morning, too, and all. Maybe we'll be heroes in 2 weeks.
Maybe,
she said, and sighed. I put my arm around her. Her shoulders were shaking.
I'm terrified, I said. I think that it would be crazy not to be terrified.
Yeah,
she said.
Yeah.
Mom called us to dinner. Dad shook Angie's hand. He looked unshaved and worried, the way he had since we'd gone to see Barbara. But on meeting Ange, a little of the old Dad came back. She kissed him on the cheek, and he insisted that she call him Drew. Dinner was actually really good. The ice broke when Ange took out her hot sauce mister and treated her plate and explained about Scoville units. Dad tried a forkful of her food and went reeling into the kitchen to drink a gallon of milk. Believe it or not, Mom still tried it after that and gave every impression of loving it. Mom, it turned out, was an undiscovered spicy food prodigy, a natural. Before she left, Ange pressed the hot sauce mister on Mom. I have a spare at home, she said. I'd watched her pack it in her backpack. You seem like the kind of woman who should have one of these.
Chapter 19. Here's the email that went out at 7 a.m. the next day, while Ange and I were spray-painting Vamp Mob Civic Center Arrow at strategic locations around town. Rules for Vamp Mob. You are part of a clan of daylight vampires. You've discovered the secret of surviving the terrible light of the sun. The secret was cannibalism. The blood of another vampire can give you the strength to walk among the living. You need to bite as many other vampires as you can in order to stay in the game. If 1 minute goes by without a bite, you're out. Once you're out, turn your shirt around backwards and go referee. Watch two or three vamps to see if they're getting their bites in. To bite another vamp, you have to say, "Bite!" 5 times before they do. So you run up to a vamp, make eye contact, and shout, "Bite, bite, 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 bite!" And if you get it out before she does, you live and she crumbles to dust. You and the other vamps you meet at your rendezvous are a team. They are your clan. You derive no nourishment from their blood. You can go invisible by standing still and folding your arms over your chest. You can't bite invisible vamps, and they can't bite you. This game is played on the honor system. The point is to have fun and get your vamp on, not to win. There is an end game that will be passed by word of mouth as winners begin to emerge. The game masters will start a whisper campaign among the players when the time comes. Spread the whisper as quickly as you can and watch for the sign. Mikey. Bite, 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 bite! We'd hoped that 100 people would be willing to play Vamp Mob. We'd sent out about 200 invites each. But when I sat bolt upright at 4 a.m. and grabbed my Xbox, there were 400 replies there. 400! I fed the addresses to the bot and stole out of the house. I descended the stairs, listening to my father snore and my mom rolling over in their bed. I locked the door behind me. At 4:15 a.m., Potrero Hill was as quiet as the countryside. There were some distant traffic rumbles, and once a car crawled past me. I stopped at an ATM and drew out $320 in 20s, rolled them up and put a rubber band around them, and stuck the roll in a zip-up pocket low on the thigh of my vampire pants. I was wearing my cape again, and a ruffled shirt, and tuxedo pants that had been modded to have enough pockets to carry all my little bits and pieces. I had on pointed boots with silver skull buckles, and I had teased my hair into a black dandelion clock around my head. Ange was bringing the white makeup and had promised to do my eyeliner and black nail polish. Why the hell not? When was the next time I was going to get to play dress-up like this? Ange met me in front of her house. She had her backpack on, too, and fishnet tights, a ruffled gothic Lolita maid's dress, white face paint, elaborate kabuki eye makeup, and her fingers and throat dripped with silver jewelry. "You look great," we said to each other in unison, then laughed quietly and stole off through the streets, spray paint cans in our pockets. As I surveyed Civic Center, I thought about what it would look like once 400 vamp mobbers converged on it. I expected them in 10 minutes out front of City Hall. Already the big plaza teemed with commuters who neatly sidestepped the homeless people begging there. I've always hated Civic Center. It's a collection of huge wedding cake buildings, courthouses, museums, and civic buildings like City Hall. The sidewalks are wide, the buildings are white. In the tourist guides to San Francisco, they managed to photograph it so that it looks like Epcot Center, futuristic and austere. But on the ground, it's grimy and gross. Homeless people sleep on all the benches. The district is empty by 6 p.m., except for drunks and druggies, because with only one kind of building there, there's no legit reason for people to hang around after the sun goes down. It's more like a mall than a neighborhood, and the only businesses there are bail bondsmen and liquor stores, places that cater to the families of crooks on trial and the bums who make it their nighttime home. I really came to understand all this when I read an interview with an amazing old urban planner, a woman called Jane Jacobs, who was the first person to really nail why it was wrong to slice cities up with freeways, stick all the poor people in housing projects, and use zoning laws to tightly control who got to do what where. Jacobs explained that real cities are organic, and they have a lot of variety, rich and poor, white and brown, Anglo and Mex, retail and residential, and even industrial. A neighborhood like that has all kinds of people passing through it at all hours of the day or night, so you get businesses that cater to every need. You get people around all the time, acting like eyes on the street. You've encountered this before. You go walking around some older part of some city, and you find that it's full of the coolest-looking stores, guys in suits and people in fashion rags, upscale restaurants and funky cafes, a little movie theater maybe, houses with elaborate paint jobs. Sure, there might be a Starbucks, too, but there's also a neat-looking fruit market and a florist who appears to be 300 years old as she snips carefully at the flowers in her windows. It's the opposite of a planned space, like a mall. It feels like a wild garden or even a woods, like it grew. You couldn't get any further from that than Civic Center. I read an interview with Jacobs where she talked about the great old neighborhood they knocked down to build it. It had been just that kind of neighborhood, the kind of place that happened without permission or rhyme or reason. Jacobs said that she predicted that within a few years, Civic Center would be one of the worst neighborhoods in the city, a ghost town at night, a place that sustained a thin crop of weedy booze shops and flea pit motels. In the interview, she didn't seem very glad to have been vindicated. She sounded like she was talking about a dead friend when she described what Civic Center had become. Now it was rush hour, and Civic Center was as busy as it could be. The Civic Center BART also serves as the major station for Muni trolley lines, and if you need to switch from one to another, that's where you do it. At 8 a.m., there were thousands of people coming up the stairs, going down the stairs, getting into and out of taxis, and on and off buses. They got squeezed by DHS checkpoints by the different civic buildings and routed around aggressive panhandlers. They all smelled like their shampoos and colognes, fresh out of the shower and armored in their work suits, swinging laptop bags and briefcases. At 8 a.m., Civic Center was business central. And here came the vamps. A couple dozen coming down Van Ness, a couple dozen coming up Market, more coming from the other side of Market, more coming up from Van Ness. They slipped around the sides of the buildings, wearing the white face paint and the black eyeliner, black clothes, leather jackets, huge, stompy boots, fishnet, fingerless gloves. They began to fill up the plaza. A few of the business people gave them passing glances and then looked away, not wanting to let these weirdos into their personal realities as they thought about whatever crap they were about to wade through for another 8 hours. The vamps milled around, not sure when the game was on. They pooled together in large groups, like an oil spill in reverse, all this black gathering in one place. A lot of them sported old-timey hats, bowlers, and toppers. Many of the girls were in full-on elegant gothic Lolita maid costumes with huge platforms. I tried to estimate the numbers. 200. Then, 5 minutes later, it was 300. 400. They were still streaming in. The vamps had brought friends. Someone grabbed my ass. I spun around and saw Ange, laughing so hard she had to hold her thighs, bent double.
"Look at them all, man! Look at them all!" she gasped.
The square was twice as crowded as it had been a few minutes ago. I had no idea how many ex-netters there were, but easily 1,000 of them had just showed up to my little party. Christ! The DHS and SFPD cops were starting to mill around, talking into their radios and clustering together. I heard a faraway siren. "All right," I said, shaking Ange by the arm. "All right, let's go." We both slipped off into the crowd, and as soon as we encountered our first vamp, we both said loudly, "Bite, bite, 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 bite!" My victim was a stunned but cute girl with spiderwebs drawn on her hands and smudged mascara running down her cheeks. She said, "Crap!" and moved away, acknowledging that I'd gotten her. The call of "bite, bite, 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 bite" had scrambled the other nearby vamps. Some of them were attacking each other, others were moving for cover, hiding out. I had my victim for the minute, so I skulked away, using mundanes for cover. All around me, the cry of "bite, bite, 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 bite," and shouts, and laughs, and curses. The sound spread like a virus through the crowd. All the vamps knew the game was on now, and the ones who were clustered together were dropping like flies. They laughed and cussed and moved away, cluing the still-in vamps that the game was on, and more vamps were arriving by the second. 8:16. It was time to bag another vamp. I crouched low and moved through the legs of the straights as they headed for the BART stairs. They jerked back with surprise and swerved to avoid me. I had my eyes laser-locked on a set of black platform boots with steel dragons over the toes, and so I wasn't expecting it when I came face-to-face with another vamp, a guy of about 15 or 16, hair gelled straight back and wearing a PVC Marilyn Manson jacket, draped with necklaces of fake tusks carved with intricate symbols. "Bite, bite, bite," he began, when one of the mundanes tripped over him, and they both went sprawling. I leapt over to him and shouted, "Bite, bite, 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 bite," before he could untangle himself again. More vamps were arriving. The suits were really freaking out. The game overflowed the sidewalk and moved into Van Ness, spreading up toward Market Street. Drivers honked. The trolleys made angry dings. I heard more sirens, but now traffic was snarled in every direction. It was freaking glorious. Bite, 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 bite! The sound came from all around me. There were so many vamps there, playing so furiously. It was like a roar. I risked standing up and looking around and found that I was right in the middle of a giant crowd of vamps that went as far as I could see in every direction. Bite, 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 bite! This was even better than the concert in Dolores Park. That had been angry and rockin', but this was, well, it was just fun. It was like going back to the playground, to the epic games of tag we'd play on lunch breaks when the sun was out, hundreds of people chasing each other around. The adults and the cars just made it more fun, more funny. That's what it was. It was funny. We were all laughing now. But the cops were really mobilizing now. I heard helicopters. Any second now, it would be over. Time for the end game. I grabbed a vamp. End game. When the cops order us to disperse, pretend you've been gassed. Pass it on. What did I just say? The vamp was a girl, tiny, so short I thought she was really young, but she must have been 17 or 18 from her face and the smile. "Oh, that's wicked," she said. What did I say? Endgame. When the cops order us to disperse, pretend you've been gassed. Pass it on. What did I just say? Right, I said. Pass it on. She melted into the crowd. I grabbed another vamp. I passed it on. He went off to pass it on. Somewhere in the crowd, I knew Ange was doing this too. Somewhere in the crowd, there might be infiltrators, fake X-netters, but what could they do with this knowledge? It's not like the cops had a choice. They were going to order us to disperse. That was guaranteed. I had to get to Ange. The plan was to meet at the Founder's statue in the plaza, but reaching it was going to be hard. The crowd wasn't moving anymore. It was surging, like the mob had on the way down to the BART station on the day the bombs went off. I struggled to make my way through it, just as the PA underneath the helicopter switched on.
"This is the Department of Homeland Security. You are ordered to disperse immediately."
Around me, hundreds of vamps fell to the ground, clutching their throats, clawing at their eyes, gasping for breath. It was easy to fake being gassed. We'd all had plenty of time to study the footage of the partiers in Mission Dolores Park going down under the pepper spray clouds.
"Disperse immediately."
I fell to the ground, protecting my pack, reaching around to the red baseball hat folded into the waistband of my pants. I jammed it on my head and then grabbed my throat and made horrendous retching noises. The only ones still standing were the mundanes, the salarymen who'd been just trying to get to their jobs. I looked around as best as I could at them as I choked and gasped.
"This is the Department of Homeland Security. You are ordered to disperse immediately. Disperse immediately."
The voice of God made my bowels ache. I felt it in my molars and in my femurs and my spine. The salarymen were scared. They were moving as fast as they could, but in no particular direction. The helicopter seemed to be directly overhead, no matter where you stood. The cops were wading into the crowd now, and they'd put on their helmets. Some had shields. Some had gas masks. I gasped harder. Then the salarymen were running. I probably would have run too. I watched a guy whip a $500 jacket off and wrap it around his face before heading south toward Mission, only to trip and go sprawling. His curses joined the choking sounds. This wasn't supposed to happen. The choking was just supposed to freak people out and get them confused, not panic them into a stampede. There were screams now, screams I recognized all too well from the night in the park. That was the sound of people who were scared, spitless,
running into each other as they tried like hell to get away. And then the air raid sirens began. I hadn't heard that sound since the bombs went off, but I would never forget it. It sliced through me and went straight into my balls, turning my legs into jelly on the way. It made me want to run away in a panic. I got to my feet, red cap on my head, thinking of only one thing. Ange. Ange and the Founder statue. Everyone was on their feet now, running in all directions, screaming. I pushed people out of my way, holding onto my pack and my hat, heading for Founder statue. Masha was looking for me. I was looking for Ange. Ange was out there. I pushed and cursed, elbowed someone. Someone came down on my foot so hard I felt something go crunch, and I shoved him so he went down. He tried to get up, and someone stepped on him. I shoved and pushed. Then I reached out my arm to shove someone else, and strong hands grabbed my wrist and my elbow in one fluid motion and brought my arm back around behind my back. It felt like my shoulder was about to wrench out of its socket, and I instantly doubled over, hollering, a sound that was barely audible over the din of the crowd, the thrum of the choppers, the wail of the sirens. I was brought back upright by the strong hands behind me, which steered me like a marionette. The hold was so perfect, I couldn't even think of squirming. I couldn't think of the noise or the helicopter or Ange. All I could think of was moving the way that the person who had me wanted me to move. I was brought around so that I was face to face with the person. It was a girl whose face was sharp and rodent-like, half hidden by a giant pair of sunglasses. Over the sunglasses, a mop of bright pink hair spiked out in all directions. "You!" I said. I knew her. She'd taken a picture of me and threatened to rat me out to Truant Watch. That had been 5 minutes before the alarm started. She'd been the one, ruthless and cunning. We'd both run from that spot in the Tenderloin as the klaxon sounded behind us, and we'd both been picked up by the cops. I'd been hostile, and they'd decided that I was an enemy. She, Masha, became their ally.
"Hello, Mikey," she hissed in my ear, close as a lover.
A shiver went up my back. She let go of my arm, and I shook it out.
"Christ," I said. "You?"
"Yes, me," she said.
"The gas is going to come down in about 2 minutes. Let's haul ass."
"Ange, my girlfriend, is by the Founder statue."
Masha looked over the crowd.
"No chance," she said. "We try to make it there, we're doomed. The gas is coming down in 2 minutes in case you missed it the first time."
I stopped moving.
"I don't go without Ange," I said.
She shrugged.
"Suit yourself,"
she shouted in my ear.
"Your funeral."
She began to push through the crowd, moving away, north toward downtown. I continued to push for the Founder statue. A second later, my arm was back in the terrible lock, and I was being swung around and propelled forward.
"You know too much, jerk-off," she said. "You've seen my face. You're coming with me."
I screamed at her, struggled till it felt like my arm would break, but she was pushing me forward. My sore foot was agony with every step. My shoulder felt like it would break. With her using me as a battering ram, we made good progress through the crowd. The whine of the helicopters changed, and she gave me a harder push.
"Run!" she yelled. "Here comes the gas!"
The crowd noise changed, too. The choking sounds and scream sounds got much, much louder. I'd heard that pitch of sound before. We were back in the park. The gas was raining down. I held my breath and ran. We cleared the crowd, and she let go of my arm. I shook it out. I limped as fast as I could up the sidewalk as the crowd thinned and thinned. We were heading toward a group of DHS cops with riot shields and helmets and masks. As we drew near them, they moved to block us. But Masha held up a badge and they melted away like she was Obi-Wan Kenobi, saying, "These aren't the droids you're looking for."
"You goddamn bitch," I said as we sped up Market Street. We have to go back for Ange.
She pursed her lips and shook her head.
I feel for you, buddy. I haven't seen my boyfriend in months. He probably thinks I'm dead. Fortunes of war. We go back for your Ange, we're dead. If we push on, we have a chance. So long as we have a chance, she has a chance. Those kids aren't all going to Gitmo. They'll probably take a few hundred in for questioning and send the rest home.
We were moving up Market Street now, past the strip joints where the little encampments of bums and junkies sat, stinking like open toilets. Masha guided me to a little alcove in the shut door of one of the strip places. She stripped off her jacket and turned it inside out. The lining was a muted stripe pattern, and with the jacket's seams reversed, it hung differently. She produced a wool hat from her pocket and pulled it over her hair, letting it form a jaunty, off-center peak. Then she took out some makeup remover wipes and went to work on her face and fingernails. In a minute, she was a different woman. "Wardrobe change," she said. "Now you. Lose the shoes, lose the jacket, lose the hat." I could see her point. The cops would be looking very carefully at anyone who looked like they'd been a part of the vamp mob. I ditched the hat entirely. I'd never liked ball caps. Then I jammed the jacket into my pack and got out a long-sleeved tee with a picture of Rosa Luxemburg on it and pulled it over my black tee. I let Masha wipe my makeup off and clean my nails, and a minute later, I was clean. "Switch off your phone," she said. "You carrying any ARFIDs?" I had my student card, my ATM card, my fast pass. They all went into a silvered bag she held out, which I recognized as a radio-proof Faraday pouch. But as she put them in her pocket, I realized I'd just turned my ID over to her. If she was on the other side... The magnitude of what had just happened began to sink in. In my mind, I'd pictured having Ange with me at this point. Ange would make it 2-1. Ange would help me see if there was something amiss, if Masha wasn't all she said she was. "Put these pebbles in your shoes before you put them on. It's okay, I sprained my foot. No gait recognition program will spot me now." She nodded once, one pro to another, and slung her pack. I picked up mine and we moved. The total time for the changeover was less than a minute. We looked and walked like two different people. She looked at her watch and shook her head. "Come on," she said. "We have to make our rendezvous. Don't think of running either. You've got two choices now, me or jail. They'll be analyzing the footage from that mob for days, but once they're done, every face in it will go in a database. Our departure will be noted. We are both wanted criminals now."